Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 741. Also, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Nerdist Community Corkboard. It's a corkboard where we post things from the Nerdist community. You can submit to us at events@nerdist.com. One of our listeners, who failed to write their name, wants to shout out a charity called Ween Dream. They bring Halloween costumes to kids in foster care or who are unable to afford costumes. Find out more at weendream.org. Also, Dead Kevin is a super hilarious sketch group based out of L.A. They're going on tour in the Pacific Northwest this month. Watch their videos, find out more about them, and get their tour dates at facebook.com/deadkevinsketch. Also, I have a bunch of dates continuing on the Fun Comfortable Tour. Go to funcomfortabletour.com for more stand-up and info on that. This episode is Mr. Paul Bettany, The Vision. He is promoting the release of Avengers Age of Ultron on digital and Blu-ray. The Blu-ray, by the way, has extra special bonus features, so go ahead and grab it. And I dare you to not fall in love with this man's accent. If you loved him as Jarvis, pretend Jarvis is talking to you for the next hour or so. But what a good dude. And I'm trying to, you know, turns out he's a Walking Dead fan, so I might be poking him. But come on, Talking Dead. So this is Paul Bettany. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 741 with Mr. Paul Bettany. Katie Rowe, the thing. That was a little more James Mason.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Not you, the dog.
No, me, me. I do lick my butthole, so it's the same. I understand why. My brain. I'm so sorry. My brain's all scared. I literally just got engaged 3 days ago.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you. And already last night, you are married. Yes,
I certainly am. Yeah.
How long have you married now?
13 years.
13 years. Wow. So you've been through all this. I didn't really, you know, past the proposal, it didn't occur to me like, oh, well, now you have to do a wedding. Like, you don't,
sure.
It doesn't just end there. It's like, now you, and literally, like, last night I get home, and she's super cool, but, so I got this wedding book, and here's all the, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to start deciding if it's a buffet style or sit down serving. This isn't like a year. I don't know.
No, and also my only advice to you, I got married on New Year's Day, so that I would never, ever forget. The downside of that decision is that I'm always monumentally hungover.
Of course.
During our anniversary.
That was, yeah, that you didn't foresee that before it actually.
I should have as well. You know, it's the schoolboy era.
So for everyone who's listening, January 2nd is actually the day. You get a day to recover, and
exactly.
Then January
that's
2nd
what, that's
is
what
it.
You want to do. But you forget it. No, we forget it.
You would remember, though. You're like, I think if it's in proximity to something, you'd be like, okay, it's the day after
yes,
a thing.
Yes, you're probably right.
It's a day, but it's got to be a big enough holiday because you're not going to remember when Arbor Day is. So it's got to be, like, the day after Christmas or the day after New Year's or something. But then do you find... Oh, you know what else is genius about that is that you guys are probably already on vacation, right? You're already on a break. So you can spend time
together.
So you
have that, and or you could do like Halloween and be in crazy costumes, whatever you like. But pick a day that you won't forget because that is appalling and they tend to frown on that. spouses.
What do you do for a 13th anniversary? What's a good thing to do for a 13th anniversary?
I have no idea, but last year was there was a lot of purchasing. So this year I'm thinking of really doing a bad job so that I can reset, you know. You have to take it on the chin every couple of years, otherwise you have to remortgage your house by the, you know.
That's just good planning. That's just a smart strategy.
You'll get there. It's you just learn it through osmosis.
And you know, at the end of your long lives, you can go back and go, you know, all those times I was doing that on purpose for you, so you know, so I could make up for it each time. Oh, you do care, you know. Exactly. And it all comes back. Yeah, I never know what you're expected to. Because it should be something that's not too crazy, but something that I think it really just comes down to, it should look like you thought about it.
Okay. I once, I was sitting at a dinner with Anna Winter, who is the editor-in-chief of Vogue. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I got this. It was our first wedding anniversary. I said, I got the first wedding anniversary coming up, and it's her birthday on December 12th, and then it's Christmas, and then it's New Year's and our anniversary. What do I do? Do I get three small presents or one big one? And she went, you get three big presents.
She combined the two.
She did. And then she said, come into my office. And I came into her office, and she had spread all of this jewelry and stuff out on her desk, and they all had little, you know, price tags. And I went, oh, you've really misunderstood a couple of things. One, how rich I am and how much I love my wife, because it's really...
She's these are the small presents. Wait, what? I mean, I guess if you're Anna Winter at Vogue, that's not really...
Yeah, don't go down that road.
I do think sometimes people that are that high in the ivory tower do forget, like, you know, not everyone really has access to all of these things and unlimited resources, so...
But there's a markdown. It's only $500,000.
It was $1 million. Now it's $500,000. What's the problem?
I'm doing you a huge favor.
No, I'm an actor. Like, it's not... This isn't... Yeah, I think as long as, because who needs more stuff? Like, people don't. You don't need more stuff.
Oh no! On your anniversary, your wife needs more stuff.
Oh, she needs
and
more
paper.
Stuff.
Paper anniversary. Don't. You know, first one is paper, right? So don't fuck
okay.
for that.
That's okay. Right. So don't try to get all real with it. Like,
no.
Hey, baby, I drew you this picture because I thought, you know, you would really see how much work I put in.
You have to spray cash at the problem. It's the only way to. It is a magical day for both of you.
Yes.
But it's more of a magical day for her. Absolutely. So spray cash at
okay,
the bottom.
These are the types of things I should be asking every guest who's married from now on until the wedding, just like one piece of marriage advice. And this is the first anniversary I will spray cash
at the problem. Then take it on the chin the next year and go and give her something really lame so that you can reset the financial cost.
Did you have a massive, massive wedding, or was it very small?
Really small. In a castle, but it was really small.
Oh, nice.
It's true. It was in a castle, but there were about 8 of us, and we got married, then we got drunk and played Twister.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, no, we didn't do it, because otherwise it just becomes this... It becomes a tyranny, the planning the wedding.
Weddings do make... And not even just people involved at the wedding, but weddings make people kind of batty in a weird sort of way. Even just like the general public.
Sure.
They tend to make people crazy. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a huge amount of pressure on that day being the, you know, first day of the rest of your lives. And it's not, you know. My feeling was I can't make it about all the people that, you know, what people tell you, weddings are about other people, you know, they're about your family and... Just make it about yourselves and have your closest friends and go on holiday.
Yeah.
We went on holiday with all of our, you know, like closest 8 buddies and that was it for a week. And we got married in the middle and it was very low key.
Oh, that sounds really nice.
It was great.
That sounds really nice. I think we might have to end up doing a large wedding, but that's more family stuff, you know. That's more everyone just looked up from the couch. Oh, large wedding. Is that should we do a larger wedding, or do you guys think no? What if we did a small intimate wedding, but then like a large reception? Does that sound reasonable?
That sounds good.
That sounds better.
That sounds good.
You know, no one wants to sit through a fucking wedding anyway. They just want to.
Given yourself two weddings.
Shit.
You know what I mean? That's two amounts of planning.
Now it's been recorded. No, but this is where I'll just throw money. I'll just spray cash at it. Like I'll just hire people. Like fix it. I don't know. Fix it.
Absolutely. Just. Again, spray cash at the problem.
I'm going to get a cash hose. And just
and never say, do you think that's too expensive? Just never say.
Never.
Spray cash.
The answer is it doesn't matter.
Nope.
Just do it.
Do it.
But it's very nice to see you in person. And I know Ultron's coming out. And I know that there's – I mean, on DVD. And I know that there's a bunch of extra stuff on the DVD which is good. It's like you have to – especially if you're making DVDs now, the audience expects you to put extra stuff on there now.
Yeah.
But what did you guys – what did you add to the
– There's a scene in which Thor and I kiss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why they would cut that out. I mean, what was Joss thinking?
I don't know. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm wearing bifocals and the rest of the world are blind.
And then they're all getting up for everyone's hungover after a big party, and Thor comes in and he was like, "I had a vision last night," and everyone laughs.
You made a vision joke.
I did. Well, you know,
I'm not joking. There's a scene in which I kiss Thor.
Oh, there really is.
Yes, no, I wasn't being dry. There really is. In fact, there's a lot of scenes where people kiss each other that shouldn't be. Kissing each other that are in the DVD extras.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Was it how was the experience for you getting to actually interact with everyone in a real way?
Well, it was interesting because I was so excited to be there and actually be working with these people that I've sort of quote unquote been working with for 10 years or so. And then I couldn't hear anything because of the prosthetics. So I was on set pretending. I think Robert Downey Jr. made a really nice speech when I came on stage. I think it was a nice speech because I couldn't hear. And I just laughed at what I thought were the appropriate points. And then they made holes and then I could hear. But for a couple of days, I didn't understand direction. I didn't understand what people were saying. It was...
Yeah, he is dolphin smooth in that role. Oh, like it is.
He's just brilliant at it.
Is that? I mean you like your character.
Oh,
is like
I thought you meant
like,
Downing.
No, you are just smooth. Like that character is aerodynamic.
Yes,
as possible.
Yes. It was you, also on the DVD extras is the both the makeup process and costume process and also the digital process that it all went through to create. That character, and it was really it's really in depth and you know great, so that's a lot of fun. Wearing the costume was less fun,
right?
Going to the bathroom is especially trying.
That's where you have to plan out your bathroom breaks for the day.
You have to plan out. You know, you really don't want going for a pee is difficult. Going for any other reason is almost impossible.
It would absolutely be impossible. But I think it's pretty great that. You know, it's sort of the good news. It's like, hey, you're going to get to be in these movies. What are we going to do? We're going to be in a sound booth for most of it,
right.
You know? So for actually getting to...
Yeah, except, you know, I mean, the other flip side of that was my job before was I would turn up right at the end, work for an hour in a sound booth, and they would give me a big pile of cash.
Oh, that's pretty great,
which
too.
Which is a great contract between
great too.
Me and Marvel, which I enjoyed. And I sort of felt like a pirate, and that's great. And then the prospect of actually being in them hove into view, so it was definitely a double-edged sword. Because, you know, I think, and Downey was just laughing when he saw me come onto stage because I think I've had it easy for so long.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then here I come, purple, aubergine colored. And
in one of the most complex, probably, makeup effects of all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot. And, you know, the first day is fine. The second day is fine. The third day, you're getting a little bit claustrophobic. And by the fifth day in a row of shooting, you really are having to find your... get very zen about it and find your safe place. And focus on the line of thousands of actors that would love to be in your position. You know?
I almost think if you go to drama school there, or at least some type of acting class, there should be acting for superhero films, because it's a popular genre. It's like, okay, we're gonna tie weights to your back, and then we're gonna cover your eyes and your head, and then you're still gonna have to figure out how to listen to the other characters and respond in a natural way.
And so that was also amazing to discover, actually, because, you know, you'd be working with Jane Spader, and there he is in this. He was you know, on set, but it was a digital creation. So he was in what they call a fractal suit, and he had cameras all around his head out on these huge huge wires. But you look at his eyes the moment he starts acting, and all of that falls away, and you're there. He's there looking like some sort of a lobster, and you're there looking like a purple, you know, eggplant, aubergine, and yet all of it falls away, and you're just left with the other actor's eyes. And sort of,
there should be a special Academy Award for that, because, you know, it's not as hard if you're in some drama and it's like we're both in jail and you're just in rags and you're in a jail and you're the environment dictates the scene.
It's so true,
you know. But you're in green screen pajamas looking at people with a fucking circus contraption on their head, and you still have to look them in the eye and
say, press the reverse atomizer projection mode button,
and you have to believe it.
Yes, it's so much more difficult than my mother's dying.
But now you're a part of this. Now you are forever a part of this universe. It's a pretty amazing, it's a really amazing time. It's an incredible thing that, you know, I think Kevin Feige is one of the most brilliant people in the world,
yeah,
with what he has managed to do that I see other studios cobbling to try to do in just, yeah, a couple of years. But, you know, he really took his time and built it organically. But now you're a part of it.
Yeah, and it's great. And you're also in this monstrous universe that is made by fans. You know, he's a fan. You know, he grew up a fan, and so I think that's why they really know how to make those movies so well. And also that when they know the rules, they are the experts on the history of these characters. And if they choose to bend the rules, I think that the audiences feel that they're in safe hands, you know.
Yeah.
So that's it's been great. It's such a creative and fantastic experience, and I love doing it.
Do you think there's a specific distinction between how British actors are perceived versus how American actors are perceived? Because I think British actors are allowed to be these kind of Swiss Army knives in theater and in film. It's like, you know, you could play a superhero, but you could also play a really heavy drama. You could also play an American Southern character. You could also play a period piece, and it just seems like you're actors. But I think, like, Americans, we get kind of locked into one thing.
Yeah, I think that there is a tendency for people to pigeonhole you, because it's definitely easier to market that, you know, because then you create a personality that the audiences are coming back to, whether you're in one thing or another thing. And I think there is a tendency for that to happen for anybody, but it does seem that it's less. There feels like there's more room to maneuver when you're a British actor. Like, they expect, it's like the accent. Everybody just thinks you're a bit more clever than you are. You know what I mean?
Hypnotic accent.
I sound like I went to school for Americans. I didn't. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't go to university. It was terrible at school, and everybody just assumes that you're sort of rather clever, which is great.
I feel like you're terrible for your education system is like A- for us, though. I mean, it's like, for you to go, I'm terrible, I only got, you know, 92 out of 100, you know, like, I feel, but for us, you know, I think terrible is actually a little bit, I think maybe that's a little bit different of a definition.
I don't know. I don't know. I think you get a long way on an accent when you come out here.
Oh, you really do, but I don't feel like the reverse is true. I don't feel like when we go to England or Europe, people are like, what an intriguing accent the American accent is. Like, it's almost, it's, you know, it's all the parts of like Dutch and German that punch people in the balls, you know, like there's nothing about it that's like, what a poetic tale of a life that person must lead. It's like, where's the Starbucks? Like, we're so fucking loud and our accents are so harsh. I don't think we get the same leeway.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think anybody, wherever you were in the world, when you saw Steve McQueen for the first time, you went, oh my God, I want to be him.
Of course.
So I don't know. You know, when you hear Clint Eastwood or whoever, any of those people. So I don't have that. And funny enough, I've lived in New York now for, I think, 13 years.
Oh, wow.
And now I hear English people. That's the only, I don't hear American accents. I just hear, when I hear English people, I go, oh my God, they're so loud. So I think it's because you're tuning in to somebody speaking the same language, and you hear the accent, and you hear a different accent, and you really focus on it. But yeah, I hear English people now when I'm in America and go, oh, be quiet.
Well, I guess especially if your wife has an American accent, if you hear an American accent,
yeah,
all day
and
long,
my kids
and your kids have American accent, yeah. You guys grew up in New York,
yeah,
yeah, and there's no trace of British accent.
No,
them.
Their friends say that there are.
Maybe they just have like a little bit of a lilt or a little bit of an affectation.
Few things, and my son had a sort of English American accent, and then he went to school, and it all
completely went away. Hmm. Do you smell the performer gene percolating in the kids?
Do you know what? My eldest son just got into Yale to study physics, and I
Jesus thought, Christ!
I know. Well, I mean, he has none of my genes, you know, so so he's unencumbered by my math, you know. DNA. So that was the final nail in the coffin of him becoming an actor, which is just fantastic. My son, who's 12, is a real prodigy with music and plays guitar beautifully and sings beautifully. And my little girl, Agnes Lark, who's 4 years old, I think she's an actress.
You can sense it?
Oh, no.
Please, anything. Anything
else? That. Welcome to a life of disappointment.
I know. Oh, wow. Yeah. But, you know, I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, people try it out. If the disappointment is such that they can't bear it, then they'll do something else.
Yeah, but, you know, I know a lot of really talented people who've never made a bean. You know, I mean, there's also a huge amount of luck and just some people are really good in a room, and some great actors are really not very good in a room in an audition, and they don't get the jobs, and they're an actor in their heart, and they're, you know, penniless, and I do worry about that. It's just, oh. And also, I think it can be a pretty, listen, it's been very good to me, I've led a very nice life, thank you very much. I think it can also, even if you're doing well, it can lead to total madness and insanity.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
Of course.
You know. You're on a job and people are can I get you anything, can I bring you anything, can I give you, do you need lunch, Mr. Bettany, do you need the, where's Mr. Bettany, he's in the toilet, could you leave me alone, I'm in the toilet. Everybody's worried about where you are, and then the job's over and they're not, you know. And I think some people have a real difficulty making that transition, and it is, I'm talking if you're on an advert, people are bringing, you know,
sure.
And then you go back to knocking on doors and saying, can I get a job? Can you give us a job?
I was just in the toilet. No, we don't give a shit now. Doesn't matter now.
So that is, you know, I worry about that for them. And also, I get so many, it's the question I get asked by young actors is how do I get a start? And I've got no idea anymore. You know, so many things are self-tapes. People say, you can't get in a room. You know, when I started, you'd get in a room, and you, even before you'd read the scene, you'd made them want to give you the job. You'd flirted with them. You'd charmed them. You'd made them laugh. You know, and they're like, I'd like to spend a couple of months with this guy. And now it's just not like that. And I just think, how do young people get started in this business? It's so hard.
I don't know, actually. I mean, you know, now you theoretically can make things and put them on the internet, and
yeah,
they can be seen.
I guess that's a...
It seems in England, though, being such a theater culture, and we have traces of that in America, but yeah. It's not everywhere. But it seems like it's a little more ingrained into the performer DNA over there, where you do start and you do crappy theater, and then it gets better and better and better, and then you more and more seen.
I think that's true, and I think that it was much more true when Peter O'Toole played Lawrence of Arabia, which I always think is his first movie, but it was his second movie, but his big sort of debut. He played nearly every Shakespeare role in the canon by the time he got to do that, you know? Mm-hmm. So he had this huge amount of collateral behind him before he was put in the position of this great role. And I think that oftentimes actors aren't supported in quite that way anymore. It's like, let's make a buck out of you. We're going
right.
to, you know, and it's I think that's rough, because suddenly you can find yourself on being hugely exposed and just not having the chops for it yet. Didn't
right.
mean that you weren't going to grow into that. So I think it's really hard for young actors right now. I feel for them.
Well, I think there's more to the learning process than just becoming a better actor, a better performer. I think it's, you know, when you start at the bottom and you have to do a bunch of shitty things that you don't necessarily want to do because they don't seem rewarding, it's teaching you how to adapt. It's teaching
Absolutely.
You how to think on your feet, how to thrive in any situation, like, which are, I think, actually the more important skills to learn how to do.
I think you're right. I think it's the same with rock music. You've got to get in a garage with some really substandard equipment and suck, you know what I mean, and
Bill
learn
and
how to be a Bill and Ted, right? and learn how to make music. And I think you're right. You know, I think it's really hard for young actors. I feel for them, unless they start taking my job, in which case
don't feel for them.
Fuck you.
Fuck back. Get the fuck back.
Exactly.
There's one, the Vision, and this is him.
Yeah. Get back in the fucking toilet. The fuck.
Who were some of your? Were you a comedy guy when you were growing up at all? Were you a big comedy fan?
Oh yeah. I think before really America really got him, Bill Hicks was a huge star.
Oh yeah, of course.
In England and. He was our sort of go-to guy from America, I think. So, yeah.
He was not representative of all the other kind of comedy that was going on in America at the time, by the way.
No, he really wasn't. He was really anarchic and brilliant and poetic. And I so many times things are happening in the world that I just think, what would Bill Hicks have to say about this? And
I just can't help but wonder if you know, he at a certain point he would have just been like, fuck all of this, and then just disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine that he would have, because he died pretty young. I think he was in his mid 34, maybe.
I think he was 34.
And so I think, you know, if he had lived another almost 20 years, I think 10 years ago he would have been like, I don't
I'm
fuck all
done.
Of this. Or he would have just been an expat and just moved to England and just
right.
not dealt with us with
well, then he'd have to deal with the English.
Did you ever see him live?
I didn't ever get to see him live, no, and I really, it's a, but I am one of those people that, you know, trawls the internet looking for rare Bill Hicks clips, because I do think he was special, you know. But other things were like Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson,
yes.
which just was extraordinary, and they're bringing it back.
Oh, they are?
For one more season.
They're bringing Blackadder back?
Yes, sir.
Is Hugh Laurie going to be
that's,
in it?
Well, that is the big, is Hugh Laurie going to be in it, and because that's the reason for them to make it financially, I guess, and I think I have read online that they are trying to work out a deal, and what would it be? I'm so excited.
When would they be? Because I just saw Rowan Atkinson was riding around England for the Mr. Bean anniversary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was just riding around on the top of a car for that. So I love the fact that character is always running in the background, and he just pokes his head up every once in a while. I would love to see another Blackadder.
Wouldn't it be great?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I hope they get it together, because it would be just fantastic to see them all revisit those roles. Because the writing was just so brilliant. It was just... That was a fabulous show.
I hope it holds up. I'm crossing my fingers.
Yeah, because all of the... the seasons were just absolutely in their own way just brilliant. The last one in the First World War in the trenches was hysterical and moving, and I'm really desperate to see what they're going to do.
Is that everything that you pursued? Did you ever pursue comedy?
No, I mean, I would love to. I was in one once, and it was, one has to make sure that they're funny before you do them. Otherwise, it's a bit like pushing shit uphill, you know, it's a bit thankless. So,
I think, you know, I'm gonna go on a limb. Even if you're pushing shit downhill, it's still not a great job.
No,
it's shit. No matter what, you're still just carrying shit down a hill.
One way or another,
you're just carrying.
Yes, you're right.
But you never know. Uphill is labor intensive. So you're like, I'm tired and I'm pushing shit.
And at some point, you can probably let go of the shit if you're pushing downhill and it takes.
And then
it
takes off.
There's a snowball shit effect.
At a certain point. If it's of a certain consistency, yeah. But there's a lot of reasons why it's not good to attempt either way.
No, you're 100% right. Yes, it is. It's something I'd love to do. Yeah, if the right thing.
You just don't ever know, though. With comedy, is one of the things you just don't ever know. Your cast can be brilliant, and the idea can be great, and then.
And you can think it's really, really funny.
And you're doing
funny.
It, everyone's cracking up, and they're going, we're making the best, it's going to be legendary.
We are changing the genre. And cut to the reviews. You know, so, yeah, I think that can be brutal.
What was your first job?
I fried fish in a fish and chip shop.
You did?
Mm. Yeah, I did.
What? Where is a good place? I'm going to go to England next year to do some shows.
All the fish and I mean, the fish and chips are great, but if you want posh fish and chips, really, and to like pay an obscene amount of money for fish and chips, there's a really great restaurant called Jay Sheiky's that you need to go to.
And that's okay to do that? That's not like violating the fish and chips code by going swank with it, not just like going to a dirty pub?
Some people would say yes. I would say no. Go for it. You can go to a dirty pub afterwards. But if if you go and get bad fish and chips, it's kind of floppy and disgusting.
You don't
but
want that.
Great fish and chips is fabulous.
Jay Sheiky's. Would you please write that down, Kyle? Yeah. All right, good. Thank you. What was your first acting job?
I was in an Inspector Calls directed by Stephen Daldry in the West End.
And how? And did you audition for that? And
I auditioned, and then he rehearsed us, and he would rehearse us with a klaxon, you know, like an old like a bicycle horn.
Yeah.
Right. So, and every time I did something that he thought was bad acting, he'd go, herp, herp, and like this.
No.
It was really funny.
Oh, my God. This is me.
I'll be in some emotional, crying my eyes. I just hear, herp, herp. From them.
This is like a shock collar for dogs. Like, that's what
it's
that's
exactly
You're just talking about revenge. How could you not get in your head when you go out on stage for the actual performance where you're just wincing?
And you're just waiting for the hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very. But it was an amazing experience. I guess my first acting job. What was my first film acting job?
It wasn't Night's Tale, was it?
It wasn't Night's Tale. Maybe it was. Was it Gangster Number One? Oh, Bent. I was in a film called Bent, the play, and it was Sean Mathias directed it. That was my first gig.
And
I think I was still at drama school, and they'd let me out for a couple of weeks to go and do.
Oh, that's pretty badass. I think I was. Sorry, guys. I got to go shoot a movie. I'll be back to drama school.
Like that.
People are going to go care about where
come
I'm shitting.
Come back wearing a long leather coat.
Dressed like Neo for some reason.
Exactly.
Sorry, guys. Don't worry about any of this. It's just
you're doing great. So that was the first thing. And then there was a film called Gangster Number One that I made really soon after that, which was the thing that sort of changed everything for me. And I love with Paul McGuigan, who does all the Sherlocks, and made a huge success of that. It was both of our first films, yes. And we just thought anything was possible, and it was a magical time. And I saw that movie recently, and it still stands up. And I'm really proud of. So,
yeah, it's pretty amazing because you you know, the more you work is that, you know, you don't always get, it's not always that. It's not always that where you can feel really, the universe shift.
Yep.
You know, so it, you can, I think, get more appreciative of that the older you're like, oh yeah, that was so great. I wish I had. Did you feel like you appreciated it enough at the time?
I think so on that. I think you have a real sense of whether, you know, because some things I've, and it's somehow separate from the success of something. Master and Commander, I knew was special as we were making it, and it was a huge opportunity for me. And I think Peter Weir is one of the greatest living and working directors that we have, and I knew that was a, you really felt the sort of privilege and the chart, and that he was just doing an extraordinary job. So that was amazing. But there are other films that I were in that weren't as well received and as widely seen that I still had an extraordinary experience of in, and I'm still really fond of. So it's interesting. It's not entirely linked to something being successful.
Thank God, because if it was, you'd hang yourself. Like, how could you live? What a terrible way to have to live by your own, defining your own success by whether or not something that you have no control over.
Absolutely.
You know, you just don't ever know.
No idea. And you know, your commitment to it, your time commitment is so tiny compared to the director and you know, the editor and all of the stuff that happens afterwards. You're not in control of that, and it's really not your responsibility. So, you know, when the experience is special, especially the way people are making films now. I was talking to Ron Howard about this the other day, and how people are watching films. You better enjoy having made that movie, because it's going to go up on a shelf, and people are going to, you know, take it out when they want. But you know, the success of a film like A Beautiful Mind, for instance, that just, A, you wouldn't make it for the same amount of money. It would have to be made for half of the amount of money.
Right.
You know? And who's to say you would have such a huge theater-going audience? You know, a movie about a mathematician made coin. you know what I mean?
Now, are you and Ron Howard a part of some weird ginger conspiracy to... were there other...
We're all ginger underneath. Even my wife.
You and Ron Howard and like Karen Gillan and like five other gingers. And this is just figuring out how to infiltrate.
How to take over the world, breed you all out.
Yeah. And then blot out the sun.
Exactly.
Because you burn very easily.
Yes,
you have to be very careful about that.
Well, there's a lot of different types of ginger, you see.
This is exactly the type of ginger racism that that's inherent in our culture.
So Spanish ginger people.
No, you're right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
And this is the fight that we're fighting.
I apologize to all my sun freckle brethren who have suffered so long because of their genetic disorder.
It's really held Ron and I back.
Why do gingers get so much shit? And I feel like maybe that's more of a British thing.
I think it is. Yeah.
Why? I don't understand what the hang up is.
There's a wild jealousy, I think.
It must be.
I think we're untrustworthy looking. That's what it is.
I always find it to be particularly charming. So I don't understand what the problem is.
Risa Hayworth.
All right.
I think it was dyed, though.
I don't know if that one was real. That one may not have been real.
That came out of a bottle.
How do you know if you're, you know, when you're in the middle of a project, how do you know, what has to happen for you to go, oh, okay, it's always firing on all cylinders. This is very special. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. How do you ever know?
I don't know if you can know whether it's going to be well received, and I think you have to at some point in your life or career or whatever step away from that. I don't read any reviews. I won't read any reviews of anybody else's work. I won't read reviews of my own work. I just step away and separate the experience. So I don't know whether you know it's going to be a success, but you know whether people are bringing great work, and that's really exciting.
Do you go to premiere? Like, do you watch the movies at all?
I have probably watched half of them.
Oh, yeah? Really?
Yeah. I don't watch all of them. Some of them are horrible experiences, so you...
you want to move on as quickly as possible.
I don't want to think about that. Or you were working with horrible people that you just don't want to look at anymore, you know?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a bummer. It's such a bummer. You know, I always say this, but I was like, I don't understand why, you know, why it can't just be easier. Because if there's so much... There's so many obstacles.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like, but creating them, it's just, I guess it's, you know, some
a lot. I think there's some, you know, there's, like in any profession, there's assholes and there's great people and there's, you know, and the great thing about my job is if you are on a job with some assholes, you get to leave it after 4 months.
That's true.
You know what I mean? And then you don't have to work with those assholes anymore.
Yeah. But it seems like, coming into the Marvel franchise, it seems like everyone's super cool.
Super cool. So really lovely, really creative, very happy. Everybody's terribly well paid. And so everybody's in a good mood. And if they're not, then, you know, it would be embarrassing, I think.
Because there used to be such a stigma behind superhero movies. Like, it's doing a superhero movie, you know. But now it's a blessing, you know.
Absolutely. And it's absolutely a blessing. And you get to... you know, it's the first time in my career that I've known that I was what I was going to be doing in a year's time. You know what I mean? That's a fantastic piece of security in a life that doesn't have much in that way. You know, the tap can turn off.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And in fact, the tap turned off at one point for me, and I was in a meeting with a producer who will remain nameless, who told me, your career's over. I said, excuse me? And he said, your career's over. And I stood up for myself, you know, and said, listen, Hollywood is littered with careers that had second and third acts. You know what I mean? You should watch what you say. But as I walked out, I stood up to him, but my legs kind of gave way and went to jelly. And I sat on the sidewalk on Sunset Boulevard thinking, oh my God, maybe my career's over. And maybe he's right. And then my phone went and I looked at my phone and it was Joss Whedon. And I went, hey, Joss. And he said, do you want to be a superhero in the next Avengers movie? And I went, yes, I do. Yes. Yes, I do. Karma was very quick that day. So, yes, it was.
No, Joss, my career's over. I don't know if you heard. I would love to, but.
I think you should talk to this asshole first. But, you know, again, if I had a dollar for every time somebody had told me my career was over, I could actually have my career be over. But
those are just social Darwinism tests, I think. Those are social Darwinism tests because I think it doesn't matter. I tend to think that's what's so fascinating to me about this business is that it really depends on what the most recent thing is. And if you have a string of shitty things, then you can try. I'm making it sound easier than it is, but it is theoretically possible to try another angle, try something else, take a risk. I think in a way, when someone tells you your career's over, it's almost sort of freeing because you're like, oh, well, I can take any risk in the world now. It doesn't matter if no one gives a shit. And then that's where you can really use that as a springboard.
Right. And, you know, the terrible thing about shit is that, you know, you don't work. The good thing is that the smell of shit goes away and people remember the good stuff. You know what I mean? They actually do. They people are generous, really, in the way they think, and they remember the stuff that you were good in or that was successful. And if eventually that, you know, that it all comes out in the wash, the shit.
The shit does come out in the wash.
And you don't have to push it.
We're pushing it up hills. We're washing it out of clothes. We're sitting in a room across from it. And it's telling us our careers are over. Like all different kinds of shit.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's important to remember that you don't have to listen to anyone.
And
doesn't really. No one knows. And most people are thinking about themselves anyway. So in your head, where you go, oh, everyone's going to think I'm a fraud. Everyone's going to think I've done something that wasn't great. They're not thinking about you. They're just thinking about themselves.
Exactly. And plus, it's sort of the way it always was, you know, the way you started your career, you know, nobody wanted you. You know what I mean? It's right. And you know, there's just peaks and troughs, and it's a marathon, not a race. You know what I mean? Is the thing that I've sort of learned.
But I also can understand why, as a parent, when you love your child more than anything in the world, and they say, "I want to do this thing that's going to bring me great disappointment," sure. and make me question myself. And of course, as a parent, you're like, "I don't want you to feel any of that."
That's absolutely the point. And also, like I say, I am surrounded by people who I think are very, very talented and just never quite got a crack at the whip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's rough, because it's not something you can do on your own. You can't, unless you're fucking mad. if you're insane, and so that you can, but you can't do it in your bedroom. You know what I
no.
mean? You can't, but you can play a guitar in your bedroom. You can paint a picture. You can write a book. You can, you know,
yep.
all of that stuff. So I think it can be the stuff of madness for people.
Yeah, I think that's why some people can get caught just in, you know, a perpetual state of acting classes, because at least it feels like you're doing something. But I do think it's nice to have it, you know, go do theater. It doesn't matter how shit is. Get up in front of people that you don't know and just perform in front of them and, you know, learn from that experience.
Absolutely.
Even if it's, I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying if you're broke and you have to figure out how to pay the bills, but I feel like, you know, I remember when I was in college, I always found money for beer, and I was broke, but I always found money for beer in college.
Sure.
So if I had said, like, "Oh, well, I can't do this thing, I'm broke," you know, "Well, how do you always find money?" "Oh, well, that, I mean, of course, you know, that,
beer,
I mean, come on."
Not an idiot.
So I think in a lot of cases, not all, I think in a lot of cases, though, you know, you can, if you prioritize things a certain way, you can figure out things
right.
to a degree. A lot of things are out of your control. But I just think I'm on this kick lately that I think more things are in your control than people actually
right.
realize.
Well, and I think that taking control of these things, you know, is really important, because there's nothing more depressing than things being out of your control. You don't have the ability to say, "Yes, you can have that job." You only have the ability to say, "No, I don't want that job."
Right.
It's offered to you. So I think doing things that, you know, what I have been trying to do is do a lot of writing and start directing, and it is peculiar, because the moment you start doing that and taking care of business for yourself, it's almost as if the universe kind of go, "What's going on over there?" You know what
yeah.
I mean? And things start happening again. So I've really wanted to start making things, and you know, Cassavetes was, you know, this sort of constant forge. By the time the reviews came out for one of his movies, he was always working on another movie. You know, he just kept moving, and he was really the, you know, he wanted change in his industry, and so he got up and did it himself. And I think that's a real lesson to be learned from that.
Yeah, you absolutely can do that. I'm sure you're very busy. I don't know if you guys are shooting Civil War now or what's going on, but I assume when you can step aside from any of that stuff, you could just go make something.
Yes, and I have, and I do, and it is it's really gratifying to do that. Yeah.
What type of things? What type of stories do you like to tell?
I think the one, I've got a movie that I directed with Anthony Mackie in it, that I wrote and directed with Anthony Mackie and my wife in it, and that comes out in November, and it's called Shelter, and it's about a homeless couple on the streets of New York City, and I'm working on a satire set in the Hamptons, so it's a totally opposite, you know. Opposite genre, I suppose.
And so when you're picking these stories, are they things that you happen upon, or just stuff that you've been noodling for a long time? Or do you go, "I want to, you know, I've done this kind of thing, now I want to go try this kind of thing"?
Okay. Well, what really happened to me, it was a bunch of things happened. I was in the last 10 years in New York City, homelessness has spiraled out of control, and you can see it if your eyes are open everywhere. You know, last year, first apartment for $100 million sold, 62,000 of its citizens were seeking shelter every night in New York City, a city home to more billionaires than any other city on earth. And that's extraordinary. 20,000 of those citizens are children seeking refuge every night in New York City. And so you can't, I couldn't help but see that. I also was deciding, God, I think I want to direct a movie, and what would I want that to be about? And I was thinking about judgment and how in a world of increasingly gray area, we seem to be becoming more and more entrenched in black and white positions. And at the same time that was happening, there was this couple who lived outside my apartment, my neighbors, I guess, and a black guy and a white girl. And I tried to talk to them. I passed them every day on the school run, and they were really recalcitrant. And I'm ashamed to say, in the end, I stopped trying to talk to them, and they became more and more part of the landscape of the city in which my family and I live. And then Hurricane Sandy happened, and we are on the river, and we have mandatory evacuation. So I was getting all the kids and the dogs and the cat and all the luggage into the car and head to higher ground. I didn't stop to think about where they, my neighbors, would shelter. And I never saw them again. And I wondered whether they would be a rather good template with which to discuss judgment and how we judge people. So that is where it came from. Then I started working with the Coalition for the Homeless, which is this extraordinary advocacy group in New York City, and they have amazing outreach programs. They have camps for these children who, you know, during summer, and I started working with them, and then I started writing the script, and I had them vet the script, and very soon I pieced together the money very quickly, and we shot a movie in 21 days with. And what it proved to me was, if you have a real lack in finance and time, but you have a wealth of talent in your cast, they can make you look like you know what you're doing.
You probably had something to do with it though.
They are so extraordinary. Anthony and Jennifer are so extraordinary in the film. I really
Jennifer Connelly. I think Jennifer people probably know that.
My Mrs.
Yes.
You know, she's an extraordinarily fastidious actress. There are some really dark places that she goes to in the movie. There's two really shocking scenes, specifically that I felt so honored that she trusted me enough to shoot them. She clearly couldn't have trusted me as a director because I'd never directed before, but I think she trusted that she could kick the shit out of me for 20 years if I got it wrong. But you know, I think sort of giving actors a job back to tell stories, because so many scripts are so overdeveloped now, to the point where even if the actor doesn't really show up, the story is still told. And I really understand that. From a producerial, I've definitely made that word up.
I've heard it before.
Position.
I'll allow it.
You know what I mean?
I
understand why that's nerve-wracking, but Five Easy Pieces is brilliant because they waited until Jack Nicholson told the story in front of the camera. It doesn't work without that extraordinary performance. And that's not to say that there aren't still great performances in English language films every year, but the 70s were awash with those films, and so I just tried to give them a lot of space and allow them back into that decision making process, and it really paid off. I think they're extraordinary in it.
So with the coalition that you work with, what is it that people can do? You know, where you said this couple, you tried to communicate with them, but by the way, a non-educated person would not use the word recalcitrant. Just want to point that out there, smart British guy. But what?
No idea what it means.
I meant that they were lacking in calcium. Just giving them vitamins. But what can people do in those situations when they have the means to help people, but then they see, but they let them, you know, drift into the scenery? Like what can the ravaged person do?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's part of what the film is about, the response that we have faced with seeing a homeless person. And it's there's almost, they're either invisible or there's almost an aggressive response, which, God, you must have done something to bring yourself to this position. And once you start talking to these people, they all have a story, and their stories, and we are one family tragedy, one job loss away from finding ourselves in that same position. And you know, my father, I grew up a Catholic, and I'm not a religious man, but my father always used to say, when we pass somebody in need like that, he would always say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." And I really miss that sentiment. I don't feel we have enough of it. There, but for the grace of God, go I, because it's an admission of how close we all are. Okay, so what can you do about it? I think that it actually needs to be legislated for, frankly. You know, one can do a lot by going to work for somebody like Coalition for the Homeless. You can drive the bus. They have a bus that they deliver 1,000 meals to New York City homeless people every night. You can go and work. You can tutor children. There's lots that you can actually get involved in, but actually it needs to be legislated for. In the last 10 years, in the Bloomberg years, he did a lot of things right, but he has a woeful record with homelessness. 32% of low cost housing has been cut in the last 10 years, and we have 62,000 homeless people, and you would be a fool and a communist to draw any link between 62,000 homeless people and a 32% cutting of social housing. So, you know, there are lots to do. There is lots to do, and one can get involved in giving money or in a more physical way, which is incredibly gratifying. And actually, when you go to meet these people that do this with their lives, that look after these people and try and help these people off the streets and out of shelters and into long-term housing, they're angels. I mean, you can't believe that people with this much goodness inside them exist. I'm endlessly humbled by them whenever I go to meet them.
Does the Coalition have a website? I'm sure they do. But what is it?
They absolutely do. It's a great website. It will absolutely help you if you're in New York City. It'll absolutely help you with being able to get involved. But I don't know, but I'm sure they have links to other charities around the country. I know there's one that we found today. I forgot what the name of it was, Mel. Do you remember? In Atlanta. Well, I can find it out for you.
Okay.
But, you know, all these major cities have charities that you can get involved with.
Excellent. And yours is the Coalition for...
Coalition for the Homeless.
Coalition for the Homeless. Well, we're about in an hour. This was an hour. It just flies by, Paul Bettany. And your voice is hypnotic in a wonderful way.
Thank you very much.
And I think a lot of people listening I feel like it's gonna stimulate endorphins in their brain. It's gonna make them very happy, and then people are gonna get you to tell stories to them because your voice is a drug.
Well, that's very kind.
But it's been so wonderful to see you evolve in the Marvel universe. And I'm I'm incredibly touched by your story and the fact that you're a performer who doesn't just think about yourself, and that you're actually trying to use work to generate awareness for the homeless. And so thank you for that. And people should absolutely get the Blu-ray for Avengers Age of Ultron.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
With a lot of extra stuff. There's a lot of making out that we've...
extra making out
just
as well.
Extra making out.
Run-of-the-mill work.
Not run-of-the-mill. It's people dressed as your favorite superheroes.
Making out. Incredibly muscly men making out.
For some reason was cut out of the movie, Josh. Why? But I guess they had to save some stuff for the DVD, so they did. But Paul Bettany, thank you so much for being here. And if you wouldn't mind, we sign off the podcast by saying enjoy your burrito. It's our way to tell people to enjoy their present life and not live in the past and the future. But your voice is infinitely superior to mine. Would you please sign off the podcast in a posh way?
Everybody out there, enjoy your burrito.
I feel like we should just put that, just use that at the end of every one. Enjoy your burrito. Where's the Starbucks?
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.